Les colloques du Collège de France.
Thank you so much for the kind introduction and also for the I appreciate being here and making connections back to that meeting 10 years ago. I can't talk about numbers, I can't talk about time, but I will talk about space and relate it to memory. So at least a little bit, that's what I can do in 30 minutes. But before I start, I want to again say happy 60th birthday, Stanislas. This picture is from when we met at Svalbard, the northernmost inhabited place in the world, except for a few places that has less than 30 people. So it's up on Svalbard. That was in 2014, but we actually met already in 26 or something on the Seine when you had just seen the grid cells and were so excited because it could relate all the way back to your mathematics and numbers and geometry. So I want to continue there, begin with some developments that have taken place in the field of space, and with space I mean navigation. How does the brain form a representation of where we are? Is there a spatial map in the brain? And of course that relates back to the early work of Edward Tolman from the 1930s, 40s, 50s, where he based on experiments in various kinds of mazes, observing that rats make shortcuts, can make detours, and not only respond in a behaviorist stimulus response manner, from that concluded that there must be spatial maps in the brain, and he then widened this out to cognitive maps that not include only the locations, the relationship between locations, but also a number of other things like events that took place at these locations. So this was very controversial for a long time, as many of you know, but things changed when finally it became possible to record activity in the brain, and then especially with the famous discovery of place cells by John O'Keefe in 1971. So just to get everyone on board, I will show a video illustrating a place cell. So you will be seeing a rat that is walking around in a box. The box has a size of 1 by 1 meter, seen from above. And for the occasion, the rat is connected to a cable. Then that picks up electrical activity, that means action potentials, from cells in the hippocampus. And we are going to both listen and view the activity of one single cell while the rat is walking around freely and collecting chocolate pieces, which is something they like. And we use that just to motivate them to run and visit every possible place in the environment. So let's start the movie. You're now listening to one single cell, and you also see red dots appearing each time there is a spike. So each pop is a spike, and you can already now see that in this particular hippocampal cell, the activity is confined to one certain location in the upper northwest part of the box. And so because the activity is at one location, O'Keefe called it a place cell, and the area where the cell is active, a place field. Then you can see to the right that 10 different example cells have firing locations in different locations in the box. So red is high activity, blue is low activity. And together, these cells, and of course there are many thousands of these cells in the hippocampus, tens of thousands, maybe 100,000, that together, if you combine the activity from them, you can infer very precisely where the rat is at any given time. And that led then O'Keefe and Lynn Nadel in 1978 to suggest in their famous book, The Hippocampus as a Cognitive Map, that perhaps this was an important element of Tolman's cognitive map. Cells that indicate location is not a map in the sense that neighboring cells express neighboring locations. So it's random and mixed, but nonetheless, for cells that have access to this activity, they can express the location of the animal at any given time. So, jumping ahead, head direction cells were discovered, and in 2005, grid cells. So this is when we started recording in the entorhinal cortex, in the medial part of the entorhinal cortex. Now you see a recording from a single cell while a rat is walking around in a box of still 1 by 1 meter. And now you can see that this single cell is also active at certain locations, like the place cells, but not at one location, many locations. And these locations form clusters that have a very regular pattern. So you can first be thought of them as triangles, equilateral triangles that tile the entire environment. And then, but because it's not a repetitive sense that, in the sense that neighboring triangles have opposite orientations, it's actually the case that the repeating pattern, the smallest unit of the repeating pattern is a rhombus. That is the same for every unit. But regardless, this worked as a grid that covers the entire space that is available to the animal. And this is what made Stanislav so excited some 20 years ago. Because suddenly there is geometry in the brain and mathematics. And this is what we then have been working on for all those years since then. But you have to know that grid cells come in different varieties, so they all vary on at least three parameters. So first we have the phase of the grid cells, and I say this because I will come back to the phase many times during this talk. So different grid cells have different phases. That means they are shifted, their patterns are shifted in the XY space. They might have different scale. That means that the size of the individual fields and the distance between them could be different. So two example cells here. Or the orientation might be different, which means that they might be tilted relative to each other. So how is this organized in the brain? Also one background information that we need to have on board, namely that grid cells are organized in modules. Modules of cells that have very similar scale or spacing, very similar orientation, but very randomly in phase. So you can see an example of this from a paper from 2012, where we recorded at that time many cells, it's about 50 cells, and over the dorsoventral distance of the medial entorhinal cortex. So this is illustrated here. This is the rat brain. The red area is the medial entorhinal cortex, where the grid cells are. This ear-shaped area is the hippocampus. And then you can see that as you start at the top, you have the small scale cells, and then it widens out and gets bigger and bigger. The distance of about 20, 30 centimeters here, and here it can be several meters. But if you plot this spacing as a function of a dorsoventral position, you will also see that it's not a gradual transition, it actually goes in steps. And even more funnily, for those who or like numbers, is that the scale is not random. It increases by 1.4 for each step. 1.42 actually, which is the square root of 2, right? So, and still a puzzle that isn't entirely solved. But again, this is extremely organized. There's no randomness in this. So then, now I come to the modern times. So now we are at the end of the 2010s and into the 2020s. And the question is, how do grid cells participate in navigation or location coding? What is their role in the spatial map and how are they made? So then it's not sufficient any longer to work on single cells, one cell at a time only. We knew that from the beginning because we have to look at the interactions of the cells, how the cells work as a society. But it wasn't possible because we didn't have the techniques. That changed now with the NeuroPixels probes and other technologies that allow us to record many thousands of cells at the same time, still at individual cell resolution. Here you have an example of a recording of, it shows 149 cells out of 2,500 approximately that were recorded at the same time in the grid cell area, and 600-700 of them were grid cells. Those 149 belong to one particular module, a small module, and you can see on each row you have the activity in this raster plot of each cell, and then so you have time on the x-axis and then cell number on the y-axis, and a column here illustrates the power of this approach, because now we can, within time beams, look at the combination of activity, which is so much more informative than just looking at one cell at the same time. But there's a problem. Now we have solved an experimental problem, and then we get a problem of analysis. But suddenly, if these cells fire independently, then you would have to follow the activity of the ensemble in 149 dimensions if you have 149 cells, and they all do their own thing. So this is, of course, difficult in many ways, both to analyze, but also because you will never fill up every position in that 149-dimensional coordinate system. So actually, if there are 10 positions only on each axis, you have 10 to the 149th combinations, which is more than the number of atoms in the known universe. So it's beyond astronomical, we can say. But luckily, not at all are all of these positions filled. The activity of the cells in the entorhinal cortex and many other places are highly correlated. So it's actually just a very small subset that is filled up. That means that you can use dimensionality reduction techniques and still explain quite a lot of the variance. So this is what we are doing, and it's particularly suitable for the entorhinal cortex because the activity in the medial entorhinal cortex is low dimensional. That means that you can actually watch very much of the activity on a few dimensions if you break it down. So you can break it down to the key dimensions in different ways. PCA, principal component analysis, used to be the normal one, but you also now have a bunch of nonlinear techniques. They all do is that they reduce this to that. So this shows a trace in a three-dimensional system, but only three dimensions, and then you can see how the activity moves around on a trajectory in that space. So what happens if we do that? First, we can begin with a UMAP approach, and then what you now see is a point cloud. And this point cloud has points that each point corresponds to a time in the on this trajectory, in this three-dimensional embedding from this 149-dimensional activity. So each point is a time point, and then you can see a trace, just like here, moving around on this point cloud during a period of 5 minutes of walking in the box. And what you all can see here is that the point cloud has a certain shape. It has the shape of a torus. So that means that this internal map, although it's anatomically scrambled in the grid cell area, it actually has very distinct topology. So the internal map, and you may say the map of Tolman, at least the spatial component of it, is this. It is a torus. And what does that imply? Well, first of all, so that's to credit to Tolman again, although he probably didn't dream about tori even. But regarding dreaming, it's even present in dreams, in sleep at least, in REM sleep, in slow wave sleep, you can see the same thing. So even when we are not walking around and exploring the environment, the activity is going around on this torus. Something is driving it around. So this is quite independent of behavior. But we have to quantify it because just looking at the cloud may be misleading. So collaborating with people from the math department. So the work is Richard Gardner's, who was and still is a postdoc with us, but then in collaboration with the three guys shown there from the math department, all from the topology group. Then we used an approach called persistent cohomology to count the number of holes in the point cloud. And with this approach, you can count the number of holes in any point cloud, regardless of the number of dimensions, even in 149 dimensions in principle, although we break it down before we actually do it to get it manageable. But if it is a torus, you would expect two orthogonal rings like this, and then you would also expect a two-dimensional hole inside the torus. And there's a way to illustrate that. I don't have time to explain how, but what you can imagine here is two long lines. That means two big holes in the point cloud in one dimension and one big hole in two dimensions, exactly as you would expect from a torus. So this happens when the rat is running around in the box, not surprising because the pattern is periodic. But as I said, it also happens in other conditions when they're running on a maze and the individual grid cells have quite distorted patterns, or during sleep, during REM sleep and slow wave sleep, you can see it's exactly the same pattern. And moreover, if you decode the position from the combined activity and then infer how each cell is tuned to the torus, you find that each cell has a position on the torus where it's active. So when the trace is going around on the torus, each individual cell is active in a certain point on the torus. And this shows just all these cells, but it shows them under three conditions, running in the open field, REM sleep and slow wave sleep. And you can see that the relative pattern where they are active is exactly the same. So that means you actually have one map that unfolds in each of the conditions. It just varies according to where you start on the torus. But other than that, it's just so rigid and the same thing all over. So this is consistent with one of the few computational or theoretical models that exist in systems neuroscience, which is a continuous attractor network model, a two-dimensional version of it, where a bump of activity is created in a network by excitation between cells that have similar phase, and then inhibition around, like in a Mexican hat pattern. And this bump of activity is then driven around by speed and direction inputs that come from outside. That's the model. And then, but then the problem is, what happens if the rat comes to the end of the world? And there is no end of the world because it's a torus. So that's very convenient because it will never drop out of the world and just be running around here. It has then to anchor this trace on the torus to the physical environment. But that's fairly easy computationally compared to remaking a torus each time. So some credit to Immanuel Kant, who sort of in very general terms already suggested that that there is an a priori presence of the ability to perceive space, or perceive the world in spatial terms. And then nature nurture, are we born with this map and then born with or innate that with that I then mean do we have a developmental gene expression dependent program that unfolds almost independently of experience, then very much in opposition to the early ideas that everything could be traced back to experiences. And the way to find out now when you actually can record from spatial maps is to ask, is it present before experience? This is a work of Matteo Guardamagna, who is a postdoc in the lab, and he recorded over the timeline of early development in a rat. And remember that rats are born very premature, so they don't open their eyes until postnatal day around 14 and ear canals before postnatal day 12. So, and then they start walking around and leaving the nest around postnatal day 15. So previously, we had been able to record after they start walking. But now, with NeuroPixels probes and very careful surgeries and experiments, he was able to push it much earlier and record from this young rat pups, postnatal day 8, and actually insert small NeuroPixels probes that allowed him to record from thousands of cells at the same time at that early age. And what are the rat pups doing at that age? Well, this is a video, and I think it's a bit funny because I say it's a video, no one believes it, because they are sleeping. They sleep 80% of their time, and the rest of the time they feed from their mom. So that's essentially what they are doing. But so no behavior, no spatial behavior, no movement around in the experiment. But still, this is what you get at postnatal day 10. So you see here, you see the torus again from different orientations. So in that point cloud, the torus is already there. Before the eyes open, before the ear canals open, they're just lying there. you may wonder, how is it possible to identify grid cells and see if there's a torus when they never have walked around? The trick is to not start out with the grid cells as we do, or a module of grid cells as we do in the adult ones, but we do every combination of cells and then look for a torus. The way to do it is to cross-correlate the activity of all the cells. So in this case, it is 650 approximately grid cells, and then just cross-correlate their activity and also time shift them and then find the highest correlation. And that, if you do that, you will see that you get blocks of activity. Like you see here, there's one, a few really clear blocks here. That means cells that are internally very highly correlated. And then just take each of those blocks and then see if there is a torus. And then it turns out that some of these clusters of cells are do have a torus. Others don't at all. Some even have a ring because they are head direction cells. But this appears very clearly on postnatal day 10. You also see the characteristic signature in the topological analysis, very clear bumps on the torus. So then, and this is just a quantification, so we can calculate the score to how clear is the location on the torus. And you can see that on postnatal day 10, something magic happens because suddenly you get these high scores here. So that means in the, each cluster, each dot here is a cluster of 50 or more cells in this diagram. And you can see that something magic happens on postnatal day 10. And you may then wonder, what is it? And if you compare now the activity on postnatal day 8 and 9 here, you can see this is a raster plot again. And you can see that it's very bursty. When there is activity, it's always, almost all of the cells participate. And it actually quite often corresponds to muscle movements, twitches. They move their, quickly their legs, for example, or arms, or it's some other sensory input. So it's sensory outside driven. And this switches completely when you pass postnatal day 10. Then suddenly all of the cells are active and it's very decorrelated and noisy. And this is what it remains like until adult age. It also corresponds with an onset of much stronger inhibition in the network. So it's a complete transformation of the network activity. It happens in the medial entorhinal cortex like here, but also in other cortical areas. So this is a, I imagine, without having evidence, that this is when the internal recurrent connections start to work in the area. So again, just to sum up, toroidal manifolds begin very early, before eye opening and ear canal opening. It is innate, quotation marks, in the sense that it suggests that there is a developmental program that unfolds a toroidal map before you actually start using it. And what I didn't show, if I would if I had more time, is that after they start exploring the world, postnatal day 15, and begin walking around, then it takes a few days for the toroidal map to actually anchor stably to the environment. But it's fast, and it's much easier, as I said, than reforming the, or shaping a toroidal map based on experience, which would require quite a lot of wiring and plasticity. But just connecting it to some landmarks is much easier. So in the final part of the talk, I will try to relate this to memory and then remind you first about two features of entorhinal grid cells. First of all, at the top, that they have different phases, which I mentioned. So you can see that in the illustration to the left. And since they have different phases, you can also calculate the cross-correlogram for each pair of cells. So if you cross-correlate the two cells here, you will, for example, get a peak of activity somewhere in the southeast corner because the blue one is shifted relative to the purple one to the southeast. And as I also mentioned, the second part here, that this relationship stays the same even if you change environment. So as illustrated here, same grid map, but it's just shifted. And the unit here, a rhombus, is then located to a different place in this grid map. And then it goes back when you return to the original environment. So the design is to record in room A and then room B and room A. It is the same map, but it's shifted. And because it's the same map, you can then cross-correlate them. Again, you take a stack of maps and you correlate them, and you'll find that there is a shift so that the peak of the cross correlation is not at the origin, but then shifted somewhere away from it. So, and it's also consistent again with the same torus, but just starting at different places each in each environment. So this is very different from the hippocampal place cell map. So it's not just that place cells are different because they typically fire in one location in a small environment, but it's also that different place cells are scrambled. So they different, in which you go to a different environment, they fire in different relative locations, and many turn off, others turn on. So it's a different subset, completely orthogonalized very often. This we showed in recordings in earlier in 2014, and it's consistent with the phenomenon of remapping that was discovered already in the 1980s by Müller and Kubi. And it is essentially the result is shown here. So what, again, you have a stack of place cells in room A, and you have a stack of place cells in room B. You correlate them, and what you get for each, this shows each combination of rooms if you record in 11 different rooms. So these are rooms here and the same rooms there. And of course, if you correlate the room with itself, you get a high correlation. So that's the diagonal. But almost all others are in the dark blue area, meaning no correlation at all. The two maps are totally independent. The only exceptions being if you repeat a room. So those are the four with the stars here. So very independent, and this is of course extremely beneficial to high capacity memories. So I put this picture of patient HM there because the hippocampus is known to be so important for certain kinds of memory formation, and especially those that are high capacity and have to be shaped, formed instantly. So how can you get from one map to the other? So there are two components that you need to have. First of all, the grid cells project to place cells, which is not definitely shown, but it's very much indirect evidence that they do it. If they project to grid cells, you get this Fourier transform, and you can make, you just by summing up these oscillating patterns, you can actually get individual peaks because the center is the only one that is retained. So this is early work, and then more importantly for this is that if you now, and this is something we suggested a long time ago but couldn't test, if you now have different modules, so grid cells, so three of them shown here, and when you go from one environment to the other, they rotate or shift or move independently in the phase space, that means that if these three modules then project to place cells, like you see here, then you can get almost an infinite number of combinations for the on the receiving place cells. So if these three modules behave independently and they project to place cells that receive inputs from them, then and the shifts are independent, can go in all kinds of distances and directions, you should get a new kind of activity for each combination that happens downstream in the hippocampus, in the place cells. So that was the idea. This could be a way where you actually transform a very rigid grid cell code to the very, very high dimensional code of the hippocampus. So does this happen? Well, only now again, it's possible. So this is the work of Kristi Lykken, who is a postdoc in the lab. And she was able to record, again, thousands of cells, most of them in medial entorhinal cortex, but also many enough, usually hundreds, in the simultaneously in the hippocampus. So that the reason why you don't get so many is that it's just a layer. So the neuropixels is kind of waste because you can only use a few of the channels. But anyway, more than enough. And then looking at the hippocampal and entorhinal activity at the same time, then comparing the two maps in two environments, in environment one and environment two, or A and B as I call them, and then test every possible shift and rotation. So first rotate each of the maps in environment two in 3 degree steps all the way around until you get to 360. And for each of those rotations, then shift the maps in the XY space. So it's probably something like several tens of bins in the X direction, several tens of bins in the Y direction, so that you end up with about 1,000 different shifts for each rotation. And then among all of these translocations and rotations, then find the one that matches best. So it could be this one. And then you see the cross-correlation for that module in for environment A versus B would be something like this. So you see a shift, in this case, to the southeast. And the short answer is this is what happens, and it's different between the modules. So this is the take-home message, and the rest I will show before I end is just confirmation. But you see here, module one, the dark color is a comparison of the same room. So whenever you compare room A with the second recording in room A, you see that it's the cross-correlogram is anchored to the origin. There's no shift. And this is, just means it's stable. But in the light colors, you see the two comparison between the two rooms, A versus B. And you can see in module one, shifts up to the northeast here. Module two shifts to the west, and module three to the southeast. So they go each their way. And that means that when there is global remapping in the hippocampus, then you have these differential shifts in among the modules or grid cells. And this next slide just shows that this co-occurs with remapping in the hippocampus. So to the left, again, differential shifts. So this one goes down, this one goes to the left, and this one goes down and to the right. So the three different modules here. And this shows just that the level of shift is similar to what you get in a shuffled, if you shuffle the locations of the grids relative to each other. So it's completely random, in quotation marks. When this happens, this is what you get in the hippocampus. You get total remapping. There's no relationship. So that means if you compare two stacks of maps from the same environment, you get the peak in the center. It just means it's stable. But when you compare different rooms, it's totally blue, which means that there's no relation. And then you might ask, so this is a final data slide, and you might ask, what happens in those few cases where there actually is something intermediate? So occasionally in the entorhinal cortex, you have similar shifts in two of the modules. So you see an example here. So and here you see the two first, module one, module two, tend to go to the southeast. And then the module three sticks out and goes to the northeast. But when it's not completely segregated like this, then if you go to the hippocampus, you actually find less remapping. So what you have here on the x-axis is the distance, the smallest distance between pairs of modules. So in this case, when the two arrows are very close, that distance is small, so you would be in the yellow area here. And then when they go each way, like before, it's in the blue area here, so high distances between all of them. On the y-axis, you have the degree of remapping in the hippocampus, or the correlation between the pairs of maps. And you can see that for biology, a correlation of minus 0.82 is pretty much, actually. So it's a very strong relationship between how much the grid cells go their own way and how much remapping or orthogonalization you get in the hippocampus. And that then brings me to the summary slide here. So This shows grid modules on the top and play cells at the bottom, room A, and then you have room B. The modules go each their way. So you see that with the arrows to the right, and the result in the hippocampus is complete orthogonalization or complete remapping. And just to again reiterate how important this could be for memory, because this is a way to convert a code that is very rigid and simply consists of a few elements, modules, and then by combination, you can actually make a code that is so rich as the one that hippocampus needs to work with memories. So this could then be the cognitive element of Tolman's cognitive map. So you make it out of space, but it is one of those cases where you actually can see that you have one code and you can read it out and make something different of it. Probably there are many of those, but this is one example. And then I just want to acknowledge all the people who have been involved in this work. There are many, many, but Maybrit Moser, whom I co-run the lab with, Matteo Guadamagna, who did the developmental work, Christy Lycken with the remapping work, and Richard Gardner, who was the main author and developed all the NeuroPixels and Torres' work 3 years ago. And of course, many others too, but these are the key persons that I mentioned. With that, I think I reached the end, and I'm at 33 minutes, I think.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.